California, welcome to my friend.
Good evening. My name's Carl. I'm an alcoholic. And Pierce has been a wonderful host. Brand new car, which is very nice to get picked up at the airport with. Some groups decide to send the newest new person to go pick the speaker up. And I love talking to new people. I really, really do. But I like talking to them in my car. Not theirs. But then Pierce just got his new car, so it's like he put a blanket down before putting my golf clubs in there, right? And we're getting up. Please watch the doors. Don't hit anything. Right? Jesus Christ. Robert, thank you. Thank you very, very much. And thank you for your friendship over the years. Jerry took me to Fleming's. And Trey arranged the golf, and I love Trey and Katie. Do have to tell you, the Jerry, the speaker last night, indeed, totally threw Trey and I under the bus. We were apparently less than sportsmanlike about this other fellow bringing these other golfers to beat us. And so for getting thrown under the bus, I mean, it's really, really a bad move to do that before somebody else gets to the microphone. And so as he was talking about how we, you know, we're less than polite about it, where we were really bad sports and really were bad examples of Alcoholics Anonymous. And let all 300 of you know, Trey and I have been planning all day how I was going to throw him under the bus. The problem with that is, though, everything he said was true. Everything he said that we did it. So there's no defense. So anyway, I'm an alcoholic. It's the most important thing that I can tell you about myself. I could talk a lot about things that I care about, that I'm involved in, that I feel are very, very important in my life. But there's nothing that is more definitive of who Carl Morris is other than to call me an alcoholic. It's the most important piece of my personality. It's the thing that has driven my bus drunk or sober. My sobriety date is January 21st, 1987. I'm 57 years old. I've been sober in Alcoholics Anonymous significantly more than half my life. And drunk or sober, the fact that I'm an alcoholic is the dominating feature of my life. And the reason I believe I'm an alcoholic is really very, very simple. It's not complicated at all. The reason I believe I'm an alcoholic is because I've got a really strange relationship with alcohol. That's why I'm an alcoholic. And the strange relationship that I have with alcohol takes on a couple of forms. The first part of this strange relationship that I have with alcohol happens when I drink it. surprise, right? And what happened to me when I drink, the book calls it an allergic reaction. And the book says the symptom of this allergic reaction that I get when I drink alcohol is what they call the phenomenon of craving. And the best way that I can describe this thing that the book calls the phenomenon of craving in my life is that it seems like whenever I drink booze, the more booze I drink, the thirstier I get. It's really weird. It happens with nothing else. An example of that, they have this bottle of water up here for me, and over the next 45 minutes to 4 hours that I'm talking with you. Over the next 45 minutes that I'm talking with you, I will probably drink half this bottle of water. I don't know if my mouth goes dry. I might finish this whole bottle of water. But once I finish that bottle of water, I can absolutely guarantee you that I am not going to go get a case of water and lock myself in the hotel room. There is no chance that at 3 a.m. I'm going to be calling up Trey. Trey, dude, I need another case. Come on. That's not going to happen. But if that was the only thing that made me alcoholic, this bizarre physical reaction that I get, if that was the only thing that made me alcoholic, well then, Just Say No would have wiped out alcoholism. In the early 80s, Nancy Reagan came out and said, Just Say No. I would have. And I imagine that you would have gone, ha ha, no. And just gone on and lived a happy, successful life just saying no. But I've got this other strange part of my relationship with alcohol, and that happens when I'm not drinking it. You see, even by myself, if I don't drink for a day, a week, or a month, I seem to have this mind that will always paint a picture that makes it okay for me to take another drink no matter what the pain, humiliation, and suffering was a day, a week, or a month ago. And it never enters into the equation whether it was my pain and humiliation or your pain and humiliation. I could care less. Sooner or later, my mind will always rationalize and justify my walk back to the next drink at all costs. So therefore, because of these two components of my alcoholism, number one, I cannot drink successfully because of this physical craving that happens. But at the very same time, I cannot not drink successfully. I'm damned if I do, and I'm damned if I don't. It's the ultimate catch-22 we call alcoholism. Because I swear to you, if I could do either one of those two things, either drink successfully or on my own not drink successfully, that's what I'd be doing. Actually, I just lied. I have no interest in drinking successfully. And really, if we're honest with ourselves, we are not. I am not interested in having two, because drinking, did you know drinking successfully means two drinks and stopping? That just makes me nervous. That's like fingernails on a chalkboard to me. And I know our book is polite and says that, you know, science may one day accomplish getting an alcoholic to become a normal drinker, but it hasn't done so yet. I know I'm paraphrasing there, but I know we're polite and the book says that, but really, medical science is never going to accomplish that because we don't want it. The basic premise is wrong. We don't want to have two drinks and stop. Right? If the basic premise is wrong, I don't care what else you do, you can't get there. I mean, so the only thing that medical science could come up with that it would interest a guy like me would be if they came up with a pill that said, Carl, if you take this pill, you can drink for 4 days straight. And nobody will go to jail. Nobody will go to the hospital, and your mother will still be very proud of you. Now we can talk. But anything that's going to limit or put a cap on, I'm uninterested. I'm going to harp on that physical feature a little bit more because the one thing, bar none, we all have in common. Because actually, if we're honest also about ourselves inside of Alcoholics Anonymous, we have a lot of things that we don't have in common because we're a wide cross-section of society. I'm sure it's true here in Atlanta. I'm from Los Angeles area. You drive 15 minutes down the road, the face is completely changed. All over the world, every single race, creed, color, religion, type of family, education, no education, you know, everybody's an alcoholic. I mean, it's a huge, wide cross-section of society, right? Alcoholics Anonymous is really the only society where the bank president, the bank teller, and the bank robber are all right here in the same room. Right? And they're all telling a very different story about what just happened. So really, if you're listening to our stories about our backgrounds, what kind of family we came from, where we grew up, and what our customs were, our race, creed, color, hey, we're going to miss the boat if we're trying to identify. And even, you know what, we drink differently than each other. We really do. If you listen closely to people share in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, you will see we drink differently than each other. To illustrate that, let's imagine this. Like we crack open the back door, we wheel in a cart right up the center here and place it right there, a big cart. And on that cart, we have all the kinds of booze we all like. If you're a top shelf drinker, we got it. The expensive booze, Remy Martin, Cavassier, okay, fine, we got it. If you're a bottom shelf drinker, we got that too. Mad Dog 2020. Guy in the back just started to salivate. And everything in between, we got it there. And if we all took a good 4 or 5 stiff drinks, real drinks, no umbrellas in there, no mixer, good 4 or 5 real drinks, we'd all be acting very differently. Right? Over in this corner, we'd have the good time crowd. Ha ha ha, fun, 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 drink, 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 talk, talk, talk. Woohoo, drink, 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 talk, talk, talk. You know, add a little methamphetamine, talk a little faster, talk, 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 talk. But we got the good time crowd over here. Right? over in that corner, we'd have the sobbers. Like, they'd get a little drunk, like, wah! Over in this corner, we'd have the fighters, right? Get a little drunk, got to fight. Over in this corner, a bunch of us would be naked. I personally would be visiting the other three corners, trying to find a couple of friends to come over here with me. So our stories are different based upon what corner we're drinking in, right? The good time corner, they get a lot of DUIs. They get arrested a lot, right? They're out there, next bar, got to go to the next bar. After hours, who's getting the booze? We're going to Fred's house. Come on, let's go. Right? They're out on the road. They get arrested a lot of DUIs. Over in the sobbing corner, they don't get arrested. They don't even leave the damn house. Right? You know the kind. The worst thing, they call you at 3 a.m. Or God forbid, these days, drunk Facebooking from... Over in the fighting corner, their stories always have probation, parole, you know, bail, mom paying for an attorney, all that stuff. Over in this corner, children show up by surprise. That'll change your life, drunk or sober. But no matter which corner we're in, there's one thing. There's one thing we'd all be doing. No matter which corner we're in, we would all be going back to that cart for another drink. It was so important for me to understand that when I was new and listening and trying to identify an Alcoholics Anonymous. Because, again, I want to emphasize, if I'm looking at, you know, male, female, what type of family did you come from? Where did you grow up? Where didn't you? Did you go to school? Not good. All that stuff. I'm going to miss the boat. But what I needed to listen to is what happens to you when you drink? And then almost, even maybe possibly more importantly, what happens to you when on your own you try not to drink? Because if I listen to that, I'm you, you're me. I set this relationship up with alcohol that I just described right from the get-go when I first started drinking. And I started drinking very late compared to most people in AA. I was 11. It's really rather late. It's rather late. We lived in Seattle. A typical morning for me in seventh grade would be I'd show up early for school, not for study hall or anything, but to meet my new friends at the very edge of the school property, the other kids that had experimented with alcohol and drugs earlier that summer. We would all meet at Loser's Corner, about 10 feet off of the school property. It's like, kind of like the way AA is treating the smokers, you know, just a little bit farther away. And we would hang out there and smoke cigarettes at 7 a.m. And we would also have what I like to call the playground cocktail. That is a jar full of whatever we could rip off out of the parents' liquor cabinet the night before. And that jar is scary because nobody's been to bartending school yet, right? And plus, you're in a hurry. When you're ripping off the parents' liquor cabinet, you're not sitting there measuring out a Harvey Wallbanger. I mean, you are just grabbing whatever's there, right? There's whiskey, vodka, cream de menthe, vermouth, all in that jar. I'm not kidding. You can imagine a 6 or 7 of us, 11, 12-year-olds, handing that jar around at 7 in the morning going, choking that down. But we would hang in there. And it was the early 70s, so we're smoking that commercial pot. Anybody remember that stuff? Four-finger lids, $10 a bag, seeds and stems and the whole bit. And it was even before Ziploc baggies were invented, when it would just be a regular Glad sandwich bag. And as you'd roll it up, there'd be like 9 people spin out. Oh. We'd pack all those seeds and stems and leaves into a homemade pipe, maybe made out of plumbing fittings and a screen. Or if we were really desperate that morning, it would be a toilet paper roll with aluminum foil and pin holes in it. Apparently you guys were there too. That's why you're here. So, by the time I'm 14 there in Seattle, I'm the neighborhood drunk, I'm the neighborhood pot dealer. I forgot to mention, but my father was a neighborhood Lutheran minister. Yeah, he didn't find anything funny about all of this at all. My parents, really good people, and they saw something was happening to me. It was obvious, right? They didn't understand I was an alcoholic, but they knew something was going on here. It was pretty obvious. I mean, by the time I'm 14, my hair is down onto my shoulders and in front of my bloodshot eyes, and my vocabulary at 14 was, whoa. Wow. Right? That's, got the Zeppelin tickets, man. Right? That's it. That's what I got to say. And my parents would, they always blame my problems on people, place, and things. Right? If we can get away from that group of kids he's hanging out with, things get better. Get him out of the public school system, things get better. They tried all of the above. But see, I'm an alcoholic. My problems are not based upon people, place, and things. My problems are based upon my physical and mental relationship to alcohol. You see, if you change the people, place, and things in somebody's life like mine, all that happens is that I'm loaded with different people. In different places, ruining different things. That's all that happens. So by the time I was 17, maybe almost 18, I barely scraped out of the public school system there in Seattle after getting kicked out of the private school system. And my parents decided that Seattle was a problem. Get them out of Seattle, things would get better. They sent me 300 miles away to Washington State University. I spent 3 years at that university on my parents' money and got almost 10 credits. At any given time, my grade point average matched my blood alcohol content about a 0.25. I did nothing at that school. By the time I was 22, this little story I'm about to tell you will let you know exactly where I stood with my family. Now, my father was Swedish. My mother is Icelandic. Therefore, I look like a polar bear. And I don't know whether this custom I'm about to tell you about, I don't know whether it's Scandinavian or whether it's Lutheran. I don't know. But at Christmas time, my parents wouldn't just send out Christmas cards to their friends and relatives. My parents would send out this big, long Christmas letter that said everything the family had been doing that year. And when I was about 22, I got a hold of one of these letters that had been sent out the previous Christmas. And as I read it, it let me know exactly where I stood with my family. Now, the first paragraph talked about what my parents had been doing that year. Another impressive year, I'm sure. The next paragraph talked about what the Morris children had been doing that year, and that paragraph went something like this. Our oldest daughter, Christina, just graduated from Cornell University in Ithaca, New York, with a master's degree in human resources. She's now working for a large pharmaceutical company in the Midwest. She traveled to Europe this summer. She saw this, she saw that. Her hobbies are this, this, and this. She's a very happy young woman. We are very proud of her. Our oldest son, Eric, just graduated from Western Washington State University with a degree in marketing. He's now working for a large advertising firm here in downtown Seattle. He loves to golf. He loves to travel. He's engaged to be married to this wonderful woman named Mary Lou, who works for a very small company here in Seattle named Microsoft. It was small at one time. And they love to golf together. They love to travel together. He's a very happy young man. We are very proud of him. Our youngest son, Carl, just turned 22. They were actually being very kind. Long story short, it's about this same time. Because it would take till breakfast to describe everything that happened that culminated in what I'm about to say. And I'm condensing a whole lot of stuff into one sentence. I just don't have the time to describe everything. So the one sentence is, a really bad night happened, so I joined the Navy. A bad night. What I'm about to tell you should concern you. If you have any, concerns about the security of the United States. But on my way into the Navy, I passed a potential test. It's called the ASVAB test. And this test that I took qualified me to become a nuclear engineer. That should concern you that the United States Navy would have any type of system in place that even maybe, possibly, or even remotely, would allow somebody like me near anything nuclear. However, they made me take another test when I showed up at that base for boot camp, and I could not pass that particular test. That test is called a urinalysis test, is what it's called. Never knew how to pass those. So anyway, through a series of events, I really should have been kicked out of the kicked out of the Navy, but they, through a series of events, they kept me in the Navy, but they took away that nuclear status thing. Thank God for you guys. And a year and a half later, I'm a lower rank than when I first came in. It's kind of like this. I knew I was in the Navy. It was obvious. I mean, if I survey my surroundings on any given day, it's pretty obvious I'm in the Navy. By God, I'd look around and I'm in the middle of the Pacific Ocean on a large gray ship. I'm in a uniform. No amount of delusional thinking would, you know, be able to say I'm not in the Navy. It's obvious I'm in the Navy. Right? However, that ship would pull into a port. I would leave that ship and take a drink, and I literally would forget that I'm in the Navy. And when I would come in, you see, what happened is I'm starting to trigger these 3-day blackouts, these 3-day drunks where I drift in and out of blackouts, right? And when I would realize, oh, geez, I'm in the middle of a drunk, I kind of wouldn't care that I'm in the Navy. There wasn't any sufficient force to say, get back to your ship. It's like, I'm in the middle of a drunk, I'm sorry, right? And then I would drift off again. And it was getting scary because I knew before as a teenager in my early 20s, I would set myself up for 3-day runs. I knew it. I would set it up. I'd know how to do it. Now I'm triggering 3-day drunks by accident. And I got to tell you, here's the problem. Coming out of one of those, it's a strange feeling coming out of one of those 3-day drunks and finding myself in a foreign country. 6 a.m. on a large pier going... There was a destroyer here the other day. I've been in the Navy about 2 years, and I came out of one of these 3-day drunks in a cheap little motel room in downtown San Diego, late getting back to my ship. And one of the tools for living I had developed during this point is that I would always try to save a pint. And I'd try to drink half that pint on my way into the ship. I'd leave the other half a pint underneath my seat. At noontime, I'd run off the ship, go out to where the car is, and drink the other half a pint. Sort of my way of sliding into Tuesday, I guess. This particular morning, I was paying more attention to getting that bottle, that half a pint in me than paying attention to where the car was going. And at the front of every Navy base, there is a guard shack where a Marine stands duty. And they're serious about their job. And under normal circumstances, you're supposed to slowly and politely pull your vehicle up to this guard shack. Show the Marine your military ID. He will look at the sticker on your car, and if everything's in order, he'll allow you to proceed onto the base. As I said, this particular morning, I'm paying more attention to getting that half a pint in me than where the car was going. And all of a sudden, I kind of look, and the Marine had his head out of the guard shack like... I was wondering what he was so excited about till I looked down. I'm still going 40 miles an hour. I tried to yank the wheel. The car glanced off this cement median that was on the right-hand side, flipped over, and bang, right through that guard shack. And I can still see that Marine doing this big dive out of the guard shack. He did this big somersault. He was back up, weapon drawn. Thank God those guys are in good shape. And it was one of those mornings where everybody's angry and running in circles and... You know, pointing at me, and I'm like, I hated those mornings, right? Where everybody's yelling, and people in uniforms and badges start showing up, and it's just, man. So anyway, the Marine was all right. They were patching me up at the hospital for minor injuries and reading new charges on me, and this is nothing significant in my life, new charges. That's just what happens in a guy's life like mine, about every 90 days if you're living the way I'm living. So there's nothing significant about new charges. But the most significant thing that happened that morning is the Navy doctors prescribed this stuff called Anabuse for me. I love the groans. Oh, no, no. And the Navy doctors sent this prescription back to the ship's doctors. And I was now under orders to show up at sick bay every single morning before quarters. And the corpsman would put this little white pill on my tongue and make me sit there for a half an hour to make sure it actually ingested in my system. Over the next 7 to 10 days, I started to experience the most cunning, baffling, and powerful side of this thing we call alcoholism. And that is, I had no alcohol in me and I was literally going insane. Ever since I'd been a young teenager, people that loved me, cared about me, or had authority over me had been taking alcohol away from me. And they always would, you know, in some form or another, they would say, you can't have this. And then they would put me in front of, you know, some sort of therapist, psychologist, psychiatrist, counselor, pastor, some well-meaning person, and they would always, in their own way, in their own language, say the following: "What's wrong with you?" Right? Sometimes they'd say it very gently and kindly. Other times they'd be a little bit more direct. And I did not have the vocabulary to say what I felt. If I would have had the vocabulary, at many times through my late teenage years and early 20s, when I was put in front of these well-meaning people, at any one of those times, if I would have had the vocabulary, I would have said something similar to this. I would have said, "Yes, I know it looks like the price I'm paying for drinking is getting high. I know it looks like that to you. I agree. I'm not happy the car is on fire either. It's unfortunate." But I would follow it up with this: "But if you knew how I felt when I was not drinking, you would not be asking me why I drink. There's only one thing worse than the price I'm paying for my drinking, and that's the way that I feel when I'm not drinking." And I didn't understand that that feeling that I would have but couldn't verbalize was alcoholism. I remember counting those days on that antabuse, just... It's been 4 days. I'm on antabuse. Now it's been 6 days. I'm on antabuse. Now it's been 8 days. 6 hours. And 15 minutes. And I'm on antabuse. And I started to look around that ship. The other men, they're talking behind my back. All 300 of them. Have you ever felt that way in AA? The only difference is that in AA, we are talking behind your back. It's not an illusion. It's really happening. Only with love and tolerance in Atlanta, I'm sure. On the 10th day, I just snapped and I went AWOL from my ship. I locked myself in this little hotel room in downtown San Diego, Plaza Hotel. It's on 4th and Broadway. This would have been May of 1986 when I first started drinking on top of antabuse. I know. Ooh. The Plaza Hotel was $13 a night in May of 1986. And they have rehabbed that whole area of downtown San Diego in the late 90s, early 2000s. The Plaza Hotel is still there. It is now $19 a night. You should read the Yelp reviews. I locked myself in this little hotel room, and I remember sitting on the edge of the bed, and on this rickety little end table, I had a bottle of vodka and a shot glass. And as I sat on the edge of the bed looking at this bottle of vodka, I remembered that the Navy doctors had given me a very stern warning about drinking on top of antabuse when they had prescribed it for me. When they had put me on the antabuse, they had said, "Son, you need to understand that if you drink on top of this antabuse, you will get one of two reactions. One reaction is you will get violently ill. The other reaction is you might die." I remember looking at the bottle and I thought, "Well, I wonder which reaction I'm going to get." I took one shot and nothing happened. Authority had lied to me again as far as I was concerned. I waited about 2 minutes just to make sure. And I took another shot. All of a sudden, I felt tingly in the face. So I looked in this cracked little mirror that was in this hotel room. And I was bright red, blotchy and purple in places. Took another shot. All of a sudden, I could feel my heart going boom, boom, boom. Looked at my shirt. I was drenched in sweat. And all of a sudden, I was like, hyperventilating. We're doing all right so far. You guys are sick if you think this is funny. You guys all look rather nice, but I actually have proof that you are obviously not well. I'm going to skip ahead a couple of years. I'm going to come back to the hotel room, but I'm going to skip ahead a couple of years. My first sponsor and his sponsor, real sticklers about that ninth step. And one of the amends I was unable to make while I still was in the Navy was that my parents had paid for a bachelor's degree, right? Remember that when I was going, right? And I didn't have one. So I was told I either had to pay them back every single nickel they had wasted on it, or I had to go get what they had paid for in the first place. And so when I got out of the Navy, I used VA benefits, and I wound up in this town called Covina, where I still live, but taking this telecommunications management bachelor's program. And in the first couple of semesters of this bachelor's program that I was taking in telecommunications, I had to take a business presentation class, like a speech class, you guessed it, for giving business presentations, I guess. In the first couple of days of this speech class, the instructor was randomly pointing at students one at a time, throwing them up in front of the room, giving them a random topic, and each student was supposed to talk for 90 seconds to, 3 minutes or 4 minutes on whatever topic was given to them. And the instructor was doing this just to see what he had to work with for the semester. And after about 7 or 8 students were thrown up there, the instructor pointed at me. And I walked up to the front of the room at a podium, and the instructor from the back of the room shouted out, "Talk about a bizarre situation in your life." So I told them about drinking on top of Anabuse. They did not respond the way you guys responded. They were like... There were a couple of guys in the back going, "Woo, right on, dude! Party!" Anyway, I'm back in the hotel room. I'm red-faced. I'm hyperventilating. I'm sweating. And I took another shot, and up it came. My second sponsor was a man named Eddie Cochran. He got sober in 1951, truly one of the pioneers of Southern California Alcoholics Anonymous. He died in 1999 with 47 years of sobriety. Anyway, he called the next thing that happened to me projectile regurgitation. This is a new level of puking I'm unfamiliar with, right? Because we all know, normal puking. It's one of the tools for living we get out there, right? You're out there in the middle of a good drunk, you get that little warning, right? A little sour taste in the back of the throat. Maybe a little bit comes up in the mouth, and you go, mm-hmm. And we all know, based upon experience, that we have 30 to 60 seconds to find a bathroom if there happens to be one. If we're driving, we've learned our lesson. Get the window down, man. Come on. You blow it all over the dashboard, it reeks for weeks, man. So we've learned our lesson, but we get the warning. But here on the Anabuse, no warning. It's, oh! Sort of this Linda Blair spray across the room. Thank God the Plaza Hotel is the type of hotel room where the toilet is in the same room with the bed. It's a design feature, I believe. Maybe to make convicts feel more at home upon release. I'm not really sure. But I found the magic of drinking on top of Anabuse, that if I were to hang in there, and this is an important feature if you're going to drink on top of Anabuse, you cannot half measure it. You need to hang in there. In fact, you might need to reach down deep for a level of commitment you didn't know you had. But what I found out is that if I keep drinking and keep puking and keep drinking and keep puking for about an hour to an hour and a half, enough of the Anabuse would kick out of my system, and I would quit throwing up, and I would just be left with red face, hyperventilating and sweating, and I'm all right with that. So I drank on top of Anabuse the last 7 months of my drinking. There's no other description of this than to call it desperation drinking. And my second, my last drunk, I was left for dead in a motel parking lot in an area of San Diego called National City. It was 3 a.m. I was in the middle of a 3-day drunk again, and apparently sometime in the middle of that drunk, it seemed like a good idea to wander the streets asking where the crack cocaine was. And the next, last thing I remember is lots of fists were flying. They apparently were not mine. And then I saw a lot of blood. And apparently that was mine. And I came to, and the first thing I saw were these bright lights and men and women with surgical masks on. And we all... Again, tools for living out there is that when you come out of a blackout, you kind of survey your surroundings, basically to figure out, was it a good night or a bad night, right? And men and women with surgical masks equals bad night. That's usually it. Now, I was getting very close to meeting you people in Alcoholics Anonymous at this point, and I was frustrated over a couple of things, but one of them that I was frustrated with was the way you were describing your coming out of blackouts. When I got here, and I still hear it, people say, I'm just so grateful to be sober because I now wake up instead of coming to. It was just so horrible out there when I was drinking because I would come to and I'd look next to me, as if you were always the good looking one. There's two sides to that story. Always. My last night of drinking, I'm being let out of the San Diego jail. I'm being transferred from civilian authorities back to military authorities again. Another one of those mornings again. People, all sorts of uniforms around, and I'm being passed around like a piece of meat. And everybody, you know, you get thrown. The MPs in the military, when they get a guy like me, they just think it's so funny. They throw you in the back of the van, and they drive fast through the city streets, and you're rolling around, and right, you're not strapped in at all, and just. You're rolling around like a wet fish back there. And they're, how's it going, sailor? Right? It's one of those mornings, and you get out, and you're black and blue, and you're handcuffs. And they tried to bring me back up to my ship's quarter deck, and that morning the officer deck put his arm up and said, wrong answer. Orders have already been processed on this loser, and the orders are 90 days in the brig, bad conduct discharge, or treatment. Now, as I stood there in handcuffs, apparently some sort of option was thrown out on the table. Now, I don't remember thinking it was a good idea or a bad idea. I now know it would not have mattered what I was thinking about the situation because I was in handcuffs. And I don't know about your experience throughout your life, but my experience throughout my life in handcuffs was always the same. Whoever had me in handcuffs, never once did they ever turn to me and say, so what's your opinion on this matter? Right? When you're in handcuffs, you go where they say. And they took me up to this military treatment center up in the north end of San Diego, and the doors were locked behind me. That's when they took the handcuffs off me. And I got to tell you, there's no better symbol of the way the country I was supposed to be serving and the society in which I was supposed to be living feels about how Carl Morris acts out there in the world without Alcoholics Anonymous. They are willing to take the handcuffs off me when the doors are locked behind me. And so I'm in this military treatment center, apparently going to have to be in this thing for 45 days. In the first couple of days, actually more like the first 8 to 10 days in this thing, they are doing medical checkups on us. They're trying to figure out who we are, what ship, base, or command did we come from, get their file sent over here, and they were doing group therapy. And I remember assistant counselor was there in the first few days, and he's trying to get us to talk, and nobody's talking. I mean, we are arms folded, looking down the ground, and he's giving us his best shot. I mean, he's just really trying to get it, and he's trying to get us to interact and talk, and nobody's talking. And somewhere late in the third day, all of a sudden, there's one guy named Paco from some other base raises his hand and says, I'd like to say something. And the facilitator got very excited that somebody wanted to talk. And he goes, yes, Paco, what would you like to say? And Paco said, well, I hear that I'm supposed to be rigorously honest with you guys if I'm going to be doing this staying sober thing. And I want you guys to know that Paco's not my real name. Paco's just a name I've always used whenever things look like trouble. And the other day when I found myself here, this looked like trouble. But you'll find out my real name when my file gets here anyway. But I want to be honest and upfront with you. My real name is Randy. Will you guys call me Randy from now on? So we are kind of like, yeah, whatever. Nice to meet you, Randy. But this facilitator got really excited. Said, oh, my God, this first breakthrough of any honesty of any of you SOBs. Later that afternoon, they gathered us all up again, and they called Randy. And Randy walked up front, and they had made this gold name tag for Randy. They slapped it on his chest, and then we were all informed that whenever staff was not around, Randy's in charge. Randy loved his new job. Right? He'd turn you in late at night for smoking a cigarette out the window or getting something out of the candy machine when you're not supposed to. And on the seventh day in this place, they took us all to our first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. At least it was the first meeting I'd ever known myself to be at. All I know, we've been in this place 7 days. And over the 1MC, it's like an intercom system through the barracks. They said, 6 p.m., parking lot, civilian clothes. And we were all standing out there, and about 6 or 7 white vans pulled up, and, you know, there's 35 or 40 of us, and they put us all into the vans, 5 or 6 into each van, and each van took off that night to a different meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous somewhere in San Diego County. Van I was in, sure enough, pulled up, and we sat in the back, and you guys started your meeting. And I got to tell you, you guys floored me. Whatever is supposed to happen for a new person when they are brand new in Alcoholics Anonymous happened for me. I did not reject what you were saying. I literally, in my very first meeting, sat there with this feeling of, oh my God, they know. They know. Jesus, they know. Now, if you would have seen me sitting there going, and you nudged me and said, okay, kid, what is it that they know that you think you know? I would have gone, well, I don't know. But they know. And what in looking back, I think there were two things that were happening right then. And that is, number one, those people knew that there were brand new people in that meeting. They knew the military was there. They knew we knew, barely even knew where we were. And they took the sharing and the sharing about Alcoholics Anonymous seriously. They were talking about alcoholism and the recovery from it. Even if they had had a bad day and something else, they were talking about the allergy, the obsession, and the spiritual malady. And then they were talking about what they were doing to stay sober. And they did it in kind of funny ways. I'll never forget this one guy at that meeting. He got called on and he walked all the way to the front. And he said one sentence and he sat down, like knocked me out of my chair. He said, my name's Jack. I'm an alcoholic. My mind would have killed my body a long time ago, except it needed it for transportation. He said, anyway. After 45 days, they're going to let us all out. And the Wednesday before, there was going to be a Friday out there. They're going to let us all out. And the Wednesday before that Friday, they gathered all 35 of us up and they put us in this room. And we're sitting there, and all of a sudden, the side door opens up, and the biggest, meanest counselor in the place. He was a Marine, and he's in his full dressed uniform. Right? He opens up the door, and we all kind of go. And he walks in. You can hear his heels going across the tile floor. Marine in his full dress uniform, and it's a very impressive, very intimidating sight. He had all his medals on, and he walked up to a podium like this in front, and we knew we were getting out in a couple of days, and he grabbed both sides of the podium, and he leaned over, and he stared at us. Didn't say a word, just stared at us. Felt like forever. It was probably 30 seconds. Then he spoke. He said, you 35 have been through one of the finest treatment centers in the world for alcoholism and drug addiction. This treatment center's been here for many, many years. And over the years, our statistics have shown us that out of you 35, only one of you will stay continuously sober from this day forward. Many of you will die, go insane, wind up in prison. Nice little exit pep talk, don't you think? Then he said, many of you will relapse once, twice, maybe 20 times, and then make it back into long-term sobriety. But according to this treatment center statistics, only one of you will stay continuously sober from this day forward. Man, when he said that, if you think it was quiet in the room before that, you could now hear a pin drop in the room. The only thing you could hear was me going, shit. Because I knew if only one of us was going to make it, it was not going to be me. We all knew who's going to be. It's going to be Randy over here, guaranteed. He's like the poster boy of the treatment center by now. So on this Friday afternoon, they're letting us all out, and people are getting released back to their ships, bases, and commands in various different ways. And there was about four or five of us that had been arrested in vehicles the night before we were thrown into this place, and we were told that our vehicles had been put into an impound lot for the last 45 days, and so we were told that we were to take our sea bags and stand on the front doorstep of the treatment center, and somebody would be bringing our vehicles to us one at a time. So I'm standing there with about three or four other guys. We're kind of looking at each other, and all of a sudden this car comes across the parking lot, and as it gets closer, we're looking at one of the guys that I'm with goes, is that Randy in that car? And we look a little, yep, sure enough. And one of the other guys says, he's drinking already. Sure enough, Randy's got himself a bottle. He's polishing it off. He rolls right in front of it and goes, ha, 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 ha. Throws the empty right at our feet. Crash. We look up. He gives us all the finger and he drives right off. I guess his name was Paco again. I don't know. Next thing that I remember of that day is I showed up at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, a 6 o'clock gong show meeting in Pacific Beach. I only remembered that particular meeting hall. We had been there a few times while we were in the treatment center. The vans would take us there. I remembered where this one meeting hall was, and I remembered it for one reason and one reason only. I was push starting my little car, a little Volkswagen with a hole in the floor, but I got a push start, use a steering, I had to put a screwdriver into the steering column and wiggle it while I push started. I mean, it's really quite an elaborate setup. And, but this meeting hall was on a little bit of an incline, right? The street was, so an easy push start. That's why I remembered where this was. And I showed up at the 6 o'clock gong show meeting. That meeting still goes on. It, back then and still now, is about the size of this section right here. And so I'm sitting in the back before the meeting, and I don't know anybody. The truth about my life is I'm 45 days without a drink. I've got a lot of information, and I'm physically feeling better than I have felt since I've been a young teenager. But there had been no spiritual awakening, spiritual experience, or even a personality change sufficient to bring about recovery from alcoholism. And what was even more dangerous than that, I didn't know I needed one. And I'm sitting in the back of that room, and one guy that night operated on his primary purpose. I'm sure there were many other men that were operating on their primary purpose that night, but this one guy was looking around the back row. And he saw me, and he came barreling over to me, and he said rather aggressively, "Hey, never seen you here before. What are you doing?" He kind of startled me and scared me, and I accidentally told him the truth. If you startle me, and don't give me a chance to think, sometimes the truth just blurts out. And I said, "Well, I don't know. I just got out of a Navy treatment center about an hour and a half ago. I don't know what I'm doing." This guy's eyes went bing, big smile went across his face. At the break of the meeting, he started like fighting his friends off. "He's mine, mine, my newcomer, mine." I didn't know you mark your newcomers around here, for God's sake. This was a Friday night, and there was something in particular going on in this gentleman's life that particular Friday night that made him especially glad to meet me. The night before, his girlfriend had left him for one of his friends in his home group. I know. So he was wondering what he was going to do with his weekend: homicide, suicide, get loaded, or grab this newcomer. He's like all over me all weekend. We went to like 18 meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. This guy was insane over this woman. In between this barrage of meetings he dragged me to over the weekend, he would throw me in the passenger side of his car, he'd start driving, and he'd start yelling. He wouldn't even look at the road. He had like one of those AA radar cars that just made it to the next meeting, I guess. But he'd be yelling at me, "You gotta go to me, you gotta read the book, you gotta get sponsored. Damn her! Gotta go to me, gotta read the book, damn!" And like, he was spitting on me, for God's sake. Now, I didn't know it, but I was getting a very early introduction to your typical AA relationship breakup is what I was getting. But I'm so very glad that that guy, that night, in his pain, was a guy in Alcoholics Anonymous who had done the work of Alcoholics Anonymous, and therefore, he understood that the solution to his pain was out of self, out of self, out of self. I'm so glad that obviously his sponsor has sponsored him somewhat like this. "Young man, certainly I will try to help you whenever I can. If you have questions, I will certainly try to give you answers. But son, if you learn to work with others, you will have a lifetime of solutions at your fingertips." It's obvious that he had taught him that by that time. After that weekend, I got back to my ship, and the one other sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous was waiting for me. His name was Bob W. He had 14 months. And I am so glad that the one other sober guy on my ship was an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm so glad that the one other sober guy on my ship wasn't somebody who hadn't been to a meeting in 9 months and had no idea what to do with me. This guy literally could save my life by doing this: sticking his hand out and saying, "Come do what I'm doing. Follow me." That's a really important way of life. Who else? What education, what level of education can I go get? What appointment and from who can I go get? How much money do I need to have to be able to reach out to the dying and say, "Come do what I'm doing," and I can literally facilitate saving his life like he did for me? Right? He was completely unqualified in all areas to help another person, yet he was the perfect person. And he understood one thing: he had to find somebody to work with, or he was going to drink. Right? And he felt like I was delivered to him like gold on a silver platter, right? And he had kind of a captive audience because I was going to have to jump overboard to get away from him. My first 6 months of sobriety, the ship would go out to sea. We'd pull in. We'd go meeting, 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 coffee, 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 meeting, 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 coffee, 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 meeting, 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 coffee, 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 and see a girl. Ah! Meeting, 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 coffee, 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 meeting, meeting, coffee, coffee. And I was running around desperately seeking for you to say something funny, clever, or insightful that would quiet this anxiety that was inside that I still had that thing that I didn't have the vocabulary for. It was still there, but if I would run to the meeting and you would say something, you know, like if Jim or Amanda were talking, you know, if I ran into something like that and they were talking about alcoholism recovery, I would get this feeling of, okay, all right, I'm all right, I'm okay. No, I'm not. Meeting, coffee, meeting, right? Didn't understand that I was still suffering from untreated alcoholism right in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. Our ship had to go out to sea for an extended period of time, more like 40 days at one time without pulling in. And that's when my first sponsor said, meet me in the aft end of the ship every single night at 6:30 p.m. And so I met him there, and the very first night he showed up with that blue book. And he tossed it down. I've been hounding about it for a while. Have you read it? I said something like, Yeah, there's like how it works. We antagonists. Some doctor has an opinion about something. He proceeded with phase two of saving my life. He was only trying to save his, but he literally saved mine. He opened up that book and he started to read. And when he was tired, I would read. And he started to share what little he knew. Right? I guarantee you, he probably, when he was trying to, you know, when the book says a certain American businessman, I bet you anything, he probably told the wrong story, you know, as if that was Ebbie Thatcher instead of Roland Hazard. Yeah. Who cares? Doesn't matter whether he got it right. What mattered, he was trying. Right? Step 12 says, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried. Doesn't say expertly, doesn't say perfectly in any way, shape, or form. What happened during that next 40 days as we went through that big book and he shared what little he knew is that I got a definition and a vocabulary for what was wrong with me. Now, it didn't mean that I was fine. All it meant is that now, when that feeling would come in, I never felt like, what's wrong with me? I had the beautiful, beautiful gift of being able to say, alcoholism. That was huge, because if I can't name it, I'm going to be misdiagnosed the rest of my life. I will wander all over the place and not even see that the true solution was going to be right here for me. 2 years sober, got an honorable discharge out of the Navy. That's the result of the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, an apparently merciful God, and a personnel man that lost half my file. That's how that happens. As I told you, I had to go get that degree that my parents had paid for, and I packed everything I owned into that little Volkswagen. I puttered on up to Los Angeles, everything I owned in the car, and I started thinking, you know what, I need to get a life. I've heard people in AA talk about having a life. I need a life. I'm going to be going to school. I'm going to be working. I'm not going to have much of a chance to go to meetings. In fact, you know, I'll find out where the meeting hall is, but you know what, I need a life. I really need a life. I am way behind here. And I decided I'd just find the meeting hall in this little town where the meetings were. And I would go when I got a chance because I'm going to be busy. And I went and I pulled into this meeting hall we call the 502 Club. And I was discouraged right off the bat because the parking lot's flat. As I told you on the Tools for Living, I like a little help with starting the car. I went into the noon meeting, and the man making coffee at that noon meeting was the man I talked about earlier, Eddie Cochran. He had this medallion that said 1951, and he walked across that room. He saw me, and he said the same thing that guy said to me fresh out of when I saw that medallion. I did the math. He was 10 years sober when I was born, for God's sake. And he walked across, and he said in a much more gentle way, "Son, never seen you here before. What you doing?" This time I had a much better answer. I said, "Sir, it's very nice to see your meeting hall here. I'm fresh out of the United States Navy. I'm 2 years sober. I'm going to be going to the university in the area. I'm going to be working. You won't see me very often, but it's nice to meet you. I'm going to be real busy. I'll stop by when I get a chance, but I need to get a life." And he had this laugh of, and the next thing he said literally changed the course of my life. He said, "Son, school and work are wonderful things for a young man to be doing newly sober. Absolutely fantastic. But that's what we do in between meetings." What he was telling me is that I need to live in Alcoholics Anonymous and visit the world instead of trying to hash it out there in the world and visiting Alcoholics Anonymous when convenient. First thing he told me to do was put new guys in my car and my life would get better. I didn't see how that could possibly happen. I got a hole in the floorboard. I got to push start the thing. But he was 10 years sober when I was born, so I thought I'd give it a shot. And indeed, the very first night that I followed this man's direction, my life got better. The new guys could push start my car. He didn't say how much better. He just said better. <laughs> 17 years sober. I know, it's okay. I get it. Just don't answer it. That's all I ask. <laughs> 17 years sober, I got married. We have two beautiful kids. Now, the marriage did not work out. I know you've never heard of that in Alcoholics Anonymous. But we had a really important task in front of us, even though we could not stay married. We both love those kids. We both really love those kids. And she is a first-class mother. And so we had to figure out how we're going to do this and how we're going to be good co-parents. And we had this big house behind the 10th green at our country club. And we got rid of that house and bought two townhouses 5 to 7 minutes apart. And the kids go back and forth. And we've actually, for the last 10 years, been good co-parents, as good as we can possibly be. And I got to tell you, I love those kids. I never knew I could love another human being as much as I love those kids. Man, it's like I met who I would die for. Their names are Madison and Ryan. They're 11 and 13. Missing, Ryan had a championship basketball game this weekend. He won. And Madison is in a soccer tournament. Anyway, but it's like I met who I would die for. I've never felt that way about another human being. I know the Navy made me raise my right hand and say I would die for you. You know, but I was really hoping it was not going to come to that. But it's like it's a natural feeling with my kids. Man, I love other people. I really, really do. I love other people. Goodness, Jerry, I love you. I really do. I do. I've known, how long have we known each other? 8, 10 years at least. Love you. But if we're out later at Starbucks and some guy comes in with a gun and says, one of you's got to go, have you met my friend Jerry? With my kids, I wouldn't give it a second thought. It's the strangest thing. And I would never trade my kids for the first drink. Never in a million years would I trade my kids for the first drink. However, I am alcoholic. I know what it means to be alcoholic. Although I would never trade them for the first drink, I would trade them for the second drink like that. So therefore, there is nothing more important than the fact that I am in the center of Alcoholics Anonymous. If you are new or fairly new and you do not know what I mean by the center of Alcoholics Anonymous, I encourage you not to finish this weekend without asking enough questions as to what that means. I'm going to sum it up with this as to what Alcoholics Anonymous has done in my life. I mean, it is everything. It's impossible to describe Alcoholics Anonymous. It is everything. It's like a fish trying to describe water. Right? That's the way I feel about Alcoholics Anonymous. But here's a good example of how it kind of transpired in my life. When 1998, I was asked to come and do this in Nogales, Arizona. Anybody ever been to Nogales? It's a scary spot. And it was a camp out kind of situation. But before I left, I called my mom we've mentioned it a couple times, pagers. Remember those pagers, right? That supposedly had nationwide coverage, but there would be big blackout areas where they don't work. Before I left, I called my mom and I said, Mom, I'm going to be in Nogales, Arizona this weekend. I don't want you to page me and me not to answer and for you to get worried. So if you page me, I don't answer. Is this because I'm in Nogales for the weekend? And she goes, Oh, you got to call up Don and Leona. They would love to maybe have lunch with you over the weekend. And I had to say, can you remind me who Don and Leona are? And they go, oh, that's right. You haven't seen him since you were 9 years old. Remember, lifelong friends of your father's and mine. In fact, Don was the best man at your father's and my wedding. I go, oh, yeah, that's right. That's right. So I gave Don a call. I go, Don, this is Carl Morris. I'm going to be in Nogales. I know you're up in Green Valley, just up the freeway. I'd love to get together for lunch. And he said, bring your golf clubs. I know you love to golf. And I'm like, well, that's true. In fact, I'm like a golf whore. I'll golf with anybody at any time for any reason. Don't even need to know your name. I'll golf with you. But how does he know that? That's weird. I brought my clubs, and on Saturday morning, left the conference, went up the road, and met him at his golf course, and we started to walk along his golf course. And as we were walking along golfing, he started to ask very specific, pertinent questions about my life. It was just bizarre. I mean, he knew exactly what school I had graduated from, what my degree was in, the companies I'd been with, the recovery homes. I mean, he just knew everything about my life and the sequence of events. By the fourth hole, I go, Don, I am really confused. I've barely got a couple of questions in to find out what you retired from. And, you know, I haven't seen you since I was 9 years old, but you seem to know everything about my life. How on earth is that possible? And what he said wraps up the whole thing about Alcoholics Anonymous in my life and my family's life. He said, easy, Carl. Every year I get your mother's Christmas letter. Have a good night.